Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Folks, Dr. Joe Cantor joins us, Assistant State Health Officer for the state of Louisiana, and he represents Region 1 as well. Doc, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Noel. It's a pleasure to be back with you.
So, Doc, where do we stand relative to our numbers throughout the state as well as Region 1?
I have some concerns this week. I think folks will know that cases really in most of the country now are creeping up. And if you look at a map of states that have registered increases over the past couple weeks, Louisiana is in the clear, but every other state around us is not. Really, every state, with the exception of the West Coast and a few northeastern states, are seeing increases. So we know that's not great news for us. And then this past week, we've seen a couple concerning data points, and I hesitate to call them trends yet. We've seen a number of patients hospitalized with COVID creep up. Yesterday was the third day in a row that we saw an increase. So we're watching that closely, and then we're also seeing the number of new cases diagnosed each day creep up in most regions of the state. Our percent positivity of all tests being done statewide last week was just below 5%. Now it's just above 5%. So I have my eyes on all of those. I have concerns. I'm not ready to say that we're going into a sustained increase, but I do have my concerns, and I need to communicate that out.
What do we can we attribute this to something? Do we have a feel?
I don't. You know, I think there's a lot of factors. You know, certainly when cases go up in other states, that usually bleeds into ours at some point. We saw that during our second wave in July and August. And I also think that, look, we have more of the economy and society open now than we ever have at any point during the pandemic. Schools are open, colleges, bars are opening. And I think that's good, but it does introduce more risk. So this might be because of that. You know, I also think people are fatigued. This is really hard. And it's just easy to let your guard down. I know I do it myself more times than I'm proud of. So I think this is a reminder that we're still pretty tenuous, and we've got to keep doing the things that we were doing that were being beneficial.
Yeah, I mean, you and I have talked about this a number of times. I guess we kind of expected that we would be on this roller coaster, and I guess it's just a question of how low the low is and how high the high is.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I agree completely. And, you know, if you look for historical perspective on this, you know, both the influenza pandemic of 1918 and also yellow fever, both of which we have a lot of experience with in this part of the country, they experienced waves. It went up and down and up and down, and they had to institute and roll back mitigation measures as it happened. So a lot of people think that this time around is not going to be much different. I think what is important is how we respond if and when we do see these increases. Do we double down on our measures? Do we kind of regroup and say, okay, what do we have to do now to get us back on a good track? We did that well during our second spike, and we'll see how it happens this third time, if it becomes a third time.
Yeah, I mean, going back to balancing lives and livelihoods, obviously that becomes a very, very delicate balance, and it almost feels like some days, I guess for you guys, y'all are sitting on a razor's edge.
Yeah, I know, and I mean, for good reason, because it's a genuine hardship on people's lives, and that's not lost on anyone. I think what has advanced the public health practice really in the past few months is we have more and better testing now. There's easier testing that doesn't require a big lab to do. So that gives us better visibility. I think we feel more comfortable with a lot of the public health mitigation measures. But my hope is that we would be able to flatten any type of increase that we see now with less drastic restrictions than we had the second time around.
The CDC yesterday, Doc, I'm not sure if you saw it, issues new guidance or a new definition relative to close contacts and what that ultimately means.
I saw it's not a big change for us. What the CDC said is when evaluating if somebody is considered a close contact to a confirmed case, and the implications of that are if you're a close contact, you have to quarantine for 14 days from the last point of exposure. When evaluating that, we knew we considered people if they're within 6 feet for 15 minutes or longer, and the CDC clarified that they consider that 15 minutes a cumulative 15 minutes over the course of a day. So if you had, let's say, two different eight-minute interactions with somebody, that would count. It doesn't have to be 15 consecutive minutes. That's actually the way that we had been interpreting it most of the time in Louisiana. The CDC, under guidance, their informal guidance to us, expressed that a couple months ago. And when we talk to, for example, schools or other settings where you have a lot of exposures, that's more or less the guidance we've been using. So it's not a big change. It does reinforce the nuance of these close contacts, and you and I have chatted about this too. There's nothing magic about 6 feet. It doesn't mean that if you're 6.5 feet, you're 100% protected. You know, there's a lot of nuance, the nature of the exposure, the risk, if there was actually physical contact, was the person exerting themselves, all of those things kind of go into how risky an exposure might be. And this speaks to that. It's a general sense. It's not always easy to make it cut and dry. But at the end of the day, we have to make decisions. So this will kind of give a little more leverage to that.
Have we got a... You and I have talked about this, this thought process around an infectious dose, you know, as to where someone may be in the lifeline of being infected and how much exposure that requires. Are we any closer to figuring that out as it relates to infectious dose?
We still think about it the same way that the last time you and I chatted. We think it's a combination of the amount of the dose, so how viremic, how infectious somebody is. You know, when you map out the course of an illness, there's a couple days right around the time that someone becomes symptomatic, if they do become symptomatic, that they just have the highest level of virus circulating in their body, expressing the most virus in their respiratory droplets, and they are the most infectious at that point. Combination of that plus the duration of exposure, how much time you are in the vicinity receiving the virus particles. Sometimes when you have a super spreader event, some of it is luck. You just happen to have somebody who is at the peak of their infectious period, the most virus. And because they're in a risk event, because they're, let's say, they're singing in a choir or in a enclosed setting and a meeting, happen to be at that riskiest part of time, it ends up being a super spreader event. And you really don't know that until you look at it on the back end. But it is a combination of those two things. But, you know, the messaging is you really don't know that until you go back and look at it after the fact. So wearing a mask, taking precautions are really the only thing you can do to prevent something.
You know, the Rose Garden event of the announcement of Amy Coney Barrett has been referred to by Dr. Fauci and others as a super spreader event. When he's asked the question as it relates to protests and marches and rallies that have been being conducted in Washington, D.C., it's kind of crickets. There's no response. But based on this new close contact situation and some of the more recent data that's been revealed, what are your thoughts about that?
You know, I think there's potential risk in all of that. from what I understand of the White House, and there was this outdoor ceremony, and then they had like a more private indoor gathering where people were a little bit closer and greeting each other. And that probably, I would imagine, was the riskier of the two. Certainly going to a protest is not risk-free. Absolutely not. You know, we didn't feel that we saw any substantive spike in cases after it here. Our contact tracers didn't really identify a real mass of cases there. But you're right. It doesn't take the risk away. And I think there likely were close contacts, in that event. There could have been transmission that we don't know about. Nothing really is 100% safe in this environment.
I just asked the question because there hasn't seemed to be the appetite for mitigation efforts at all by the political leaders relative to those types of events.
You know, when I see a mass gathering outside, I'm looking to see, number one, are people wearing masks? And number two, are they doing as good of a job as they can to keep their distance? Some events are better than others, but, you know, I think if you do those two things, it's a decent mitigating effort, although nothing is 100% here.
All right, we're going to get to a break. We'll be right back with Dr. Joe Kanner, Assistant State Health Officer. Stay with us, 504-260-1870 on the Mortgage Financial phone and text line. This is Newell on WWL. We're back with Dr. Joe Kanner, Assistant State Health Officer for the state of Louisiana. Doc, recently, yet another poll, the Stat-Harris poll, shows that the share of Americans interested in getting the vaccine, the COVID-19 vaccine, as soon as possible, is dropping precipitously. 69% of those in the latter part of August said that they would. That's just over two-thirds of the population. Has now dropped to 58% of the U.S. public. How concerning is this?
Yeah, I have mild concerns about it. The discourse is so confusing and it does get politicized. I expect that to get better because at the moment there's just more questions than answers about the vaccine. And I have more questions than I have answers as well. We don't know which one's going to be approved, what that approval is going to entail, who it's going to be approved for, and what the data is going to be that supports it. Those questions are only going to get answered going forward. So as time goes on and these trials progress, we're going to fill in those details. We'll be able to communicate those details. We'll be able to communicate a better sense of what the anticipated efficacy of the vaccine is and what the real risks might be. And I think that needle moves once we're able to have a more intelligent conversation about those facts, give people the data, let them make their own decision.
What I found kind of really disconcerting in this poll and others is that just by a slim majority, people willing to social distance and wear a mask.
Yeah, that concerns me much more because the data on those items only gets stronger and stronger, and everybody wants to open things up and get life back to normal, but the only way that we're going to be able to safely do that is if we mask and distance. Otherwise, the whole thing goes to pot and our cases are going to skyrocket. So that does concern me, and I get frustrated sometimes that we haven't been able to message that in a way that resonates across ideologies, political spectrums. I mean, the public health measures shouldn't be so controversial.
Yeah, I mean, you know, several months ago there was a wider disparity amongst conservatives and liberals or Republicans and Democrats. That gap seems to be closing. And, even amongst the races, this poll relative to the vaccine, what I found very interesting and kind of disconcerting as well is the precipitous drop of those in the African American community that have any confidence in this vaccine at all.
Yeah, that concerns me a lot. Marginalized communities around the country, but nowhere more so than Louisiana, have felt the brunt of this in the way that other communities have not. They've had disparate effects of this. You know, for example, in Louisiana, 40-odd% fatalities were in African Americans. They only constitute about 23 population. And that goes across a number of different smaller localities here. I'll tell you, I think there's institutional racism in the healthcare setting. I think it goes back decades. I still work clinically, and I occasionally see patients who either have congenital syphilis or have a relative that has congenital syphilis because they were subjects of the Tuskegee experiment. So with that type of historical perspective, it doesn't really shock me that there's this mistrust. I think we have to really focus on addressing it because we want the vaccine to be available for every community that needs it. That's really important to me.
How much worse would it be in other states that don't have the charity system that we have here?
I think, when you have a poor state that has a lot of health inequities, anytime you have a stressor, it exacerbates that. What we found here for any emergency, it doesn't make it matter if it's a infectious disease, pandemic, or hurricane, or anything. Vulnerable people are vulnerable. And any acute stressor just makes that ever more so. So, I think there's been a lot of attention paid sort of that specific item here, particularly after Katrina. We've actually, led a number of other states thinking along those lines. But, I think this rips the lid off of health disparities, and it's difficult. It was difficult for a lot of people to ignore it before. It's impossible to ignore it now.
But is it more race than it is socioeconomic class driven? Poverty?
I think it's both. I think it's both. I think poverty, socioeconomic class is a big, big part of it. I mean, if you live in a crowded, multi-generational house, your exposure to COVID is going to be increased because if one person in your house gets sick, likely everyone's getting sick. That's a big part of it. But studies have shown in general for health disparities that they exist on racial lines above and beyond economic and socioeconomic factors. And for example, African-American patients across socioeconomic class typically get treated differently in hospitals. And there's good data to back that up. So it's multifactorial and complex, to say the least.
Yeah. Because I look at my own place in life there's difficulty getting in to see a primary care physician. Obviously, I have a lot of friends that are involved in medicine, but yet I still go out and pay a concierge doctor, not even in my hometown, in a different town, for a number of reasons. But I'm paying through the nose just so that I can have access.
Yeah, and that's like the macro. Just the access to care is a big part. It gets more granite than that. I'll give an example. We had to take our baby girl into the ER last night. She's fine, thankfully. The majority of the doctors and nurses that cared for us looked like me and my wife, had a relatively shared set of experiences. And that clinical encounter went very well. And that's a luxury that not everyone has. And it's
right.
Small things like that that put marginalized communities at a disadvantage. And I think it's easy to forget that unless you have personal perspective on it.
Yeah, no doubt. Doc, the FDA advisory panel, I think, was meeting today, if I'm not mistaken, VRBPAC. Very few people know the importance of VRBPAC. You and I have talked a little bit about it before, which is kind of the advisory panel to the FDA, made up of a whole host of scientists, medical experts, members of the public, members of pharma as well. And a lot of folks are saying it was important that they meet in order to kind of squelch some of the criticisms and observations made by some of the political leaders that the FDA has become nothing but a political process.
Yeah, I agree that it's good that they met. I've been encouraged by what the FDA has done really over the past 2 or 3 weeks. They took some hits a month or two ago, but really over the past few weeks, they've made it very clear, that Dr. Hahn, the director, and he's been supported by Dr. Fauci and Dr. Birx. made it very clear that, they will do their best job to not allow politics into their vaccine approval process. They've talked openly about what would and would not be reasonable in terms of approving the vaccine under an emergency use authorization. That's the route that they tend to go, and I think they likely will. And they've said that they do not intend to cut corners or make data transparent. So I've been encouraged to hear them say that. I believe Dr. Hahn when he says that. I believe Dr. Fauci when he vouches for Dr. Hahn. And I think that they're doing the right thing now. So I think they're in a better place now than we feared they might be a couple months ago when the level of discourse was getting a little high.
But I kind of question that because as I was probably read at least a half a dozen or, 10 different articles about this, I'm not sure that the FDA was ever much moved by the political discourse on either side of the aisle. And they finally decided that, they were tired of taking the public relations hit because they had never really, they're apolitical, they really had never responded to what was being said. And it seemed to me that they just finally decided that this is important enough for our voice to be heard, so we're going to have it heard. Because when you listen to the individual members of VRBPAC and some of the other scientists involved in the FDA, it seems to me none of them were moved by what talking head politicians were saying.
Yeah, I guess, for me, it sometimes it's difficult to just parse out the public comments that they make from really what's going on behind the scenes, which I'm not always privy to. I was disappointed in the FDA when the manner in which they announced the emergency use authorization for convalescent plasma. They did that, I think, about a month or so ago. Dr. Hahn really butchered some scientific studies and said some stats that were immediately disproved and came off looking like a political hack doing that. He quickly recovered. He apologized for that. And I think he learned his lesson. So I've been encouraged since then.
Also, what I see as encouraging, a number of the members have conflicts, which are expected because they lead large medical institutions that are clinical trial sites and stuff. And it's important, I think, for the public to know that there's a process by which these folks, they identify their conflict and they are replaced as it relates to the advisory that's going to be made to the FDA relative to COVID-19 by other leading medical experts in their field.
Yeah, completely agree. I think the nature of this is a lot of the people who are most familiar with this body of work, the real experts, also have conflicts. They've worked with industry, which kind of is par for the course. I think they need to disclose that. They need to acknowledge that. And there's usually a process for working through what type of recusal might need to happen. But what I can see, at least from my end of it, it seems to be going fairly well. And as the process is.
Yeah, and obviously, there was a lot of political chatter about having a vaccine before the election. That's not going to happen, which is, I think, another indication that they will continue to adhere to their protocols as any particular challenge may reveal itself through their process. But when you think about this, you think about what Governor Cuomo is saying in New York, which I think is very problematic because... And I'm just kind of curious as to what your position may be on this. He says that he's going to hire his own scientists, but at the end of the day, they're going to be evaluating the same data that the whole rest of the scientific world is evaluating anyway. Is that not correct?
Yeah, and we've talked about that amongst our team, whether we think that's a good idea. I think California might be doing something similar. And at the end of the day, the FDA is going to be privy to patient-level data that other entities won't be privy to. So I don't know how you render a full decision when you don't have that much visibility on it. I mean, the FDA, they're world experts in evaluating the safety and efficacy of clinical trials. That's what they do. I don't see us being able to do it any better than them. So I tend to agree with you. I think think I'll be looking to see as much data be made transparent as possible. And I think we would raise our voice if that wasn't the case. But the folks at the FDA, both the ones that work for the agency and the outside independent experts that they've moved in, they're really the best in the world at this, and I tend to trust them.
Yeah, I was really impressed. One of the physicians, Dr. Cody Meisner, director of pediatric infectious diseases at Tufts University School of Medicine, he said, you know, I don't feel any political pressure at all. He goes, but I know the optics around COVID vaccine approvals are enormously important to their acceptance and use. And he makes the following observation, which I thought he was spot on. He says, we're going to get one chance to introduce a vaccine. And if that goes badly, it's going to be a long time before we get another COVID-19 vaccine. Your thoughts?
Yeah. I mean, if they did something to lose public trust on that first try, the implications of that would be long-standing. And furthermore, you know, this is in medicine, when you cut corners, it comes to bite you, always. You know, whether it's the next day, the next week, or a year down the road. And if corners are cut on this vaccine development process, whether it's on the FDA side or whether it's on industry side, there'll be ramifications that will come out that will be excruciating to the public. And everyone in that process knows that. So I don't see them willing to take that risk. I really don't.
Yeah, I mean, and when you add the backdrop is when we first started this conversation about what's going on around the country right now with these new surges of COVID-19 cases, really, there's really not a part of the United States that's untouched geographically by this. I mean, it really brings this to the forefront in the magnitude of it. I get that there's a lot of pressure on them, but I guess there's probably an equal amount of pressure that they do get it right.
Yeah, and I think that's the larger pressure. I really do, because if they don't get it right, that's not something you can sweep under the rug when you distribute a vaccine at scale, I mean, really to the whole country. Tiny, tiny lapses in the quality process become big, big problems. And look, you know, these so far we've had two major trials temporarily halted while they investigate potential side effects. And that's a frustrating thing if you're working on the trial, if you're that company. Nobody wants to see that, but it's the right move, it's the safe move, and they did it, and they made that public. So that's, to me, although a minor setback, encouraging and evidence that they're doing this the right way.
Doc, the numbers you alluded to earlier, we last week, I believe, hit over 70,000 cases a day in this country. In some states, they haven't increased the amount of testing like we have here, but the level that they've been at since probably July, early August are beginning to obviously reveal a higher positivity rate. And we're really seeing it move from the urban, you know, inner city areas. It's now hitting the farmland.
Yeah, it's hitting everywhere. You know, just because you live in a rural community, I think there's probably some level of protection because you just don't tend to be in close proximity with as many people, but that's not anywhere close to absolute. So that's what we're seeing now. You know, our second wave in Louisiana around July and August, I mean, that did a good number on rural communities here as well. So we've kind of been through it. But, you know, I'm always shocked when I hear accounts of people that think that their house or their neighborhood or community is kind of protected from this, because I don't think anyone really is protected at this point.
Yeah, I wish my neighborhood was, so the increase in the value of my home would go up.
Right.
I tend to have a little bit of a selfish approach to this sometimes, right?
All right. That's life.
Yeah, we'll be right back with Dr. Joe Cantor's final thoughts, the Assistant State Health Officer for the state of Louisiana. Stay with us, folks. We're back. We're talking to Dr. Joe Cantor, Assistant State Health Officer for the state of Louisiana. Doc, one last question. A lot of folks are saying it's too early to really tell whether or not bringing kids back into the school environment on the respective campuses has had an impact yet on a number of cases. So I ask, how closely are we monitoring school data?
Very closely. We get every case reported to us, and then you can go into the dashboard and see a breakdown of cases in K-12 schools broken down to the parish level. So we track it closely. You know, we've seen a handful of cases. There's no question about that. We've not seen a lot of transmission between kids. There is a lot of disruption, a lot of quarantining, some closures, but not a lot of transmission. The one caveat I'll say to that is extracurriculars. We have seen a fair amount of transmission in football practice and the weight room and other extracurriculars. And I think people might let their guard down once they're out of, you know, the formal school day.
And is there a response that there's a modification, a mitigation there when that does reveal itself?
There is. We work with the school. If it's a football or another sport, we'll work with the coach and try and, you know, reiterate the precautions. I think, you know, particularly like on that athletic team where the kids are all really familiar with each other and they have a good atmosphere, a good bond, that the tendency is to let your guard down, and that is dangerous. So those are the type of messages that we reinforce. I think by and large, the schools have been cooperative with that. And on the education setting in general, I think educators have been great. Schools have worked really hard to make a safe environment. And with the exception of some of these extracurriculars, I think that really shows. And they should be proud of that.
Yeah, absolutely. That's good to hear. I mean, because it seems as though the CDC and others have expressed some concern yet that it's still preliminary or too early to really tell. But, you know, we've kind of been a little bit ahead of the curve as opposed to the rest of the country, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think it is early. So all this data can change. But and we have had some cases. I don't want to say we haven't. But it hasn't been a giant surge in cases that some people fear.
Right, right. Doc, closing thoughts. Let me just say thank you again. The listening audience, I know, always appreciates your observations during our hour. Your final thoughts?
Thanks, Noah. I appreciate you saying that. Listen, you know, I'm looking at the data. I kind of see some storm clouds forming. It's certainly raining pretty hard in other states right now. So people need to be careful, take precautions. You know, and that goes for Halloween coming up as well. And the other thing to mention is get your flu shot if you haven't done it yet. Time to do it is now. And we have a flu fair at the Elyria Center this Saturday, the 24th, all day, free, open to the public. Anyone can come, get your flu shot there or anywhere else, but time to do it is now.
And that's going to be, I'll get the hours at the Elyria Center this Saturday. You need to take advantage of that. I got one at one of the local pharmacy stores. It took me less than 2 minutes. I mean, it was just in and out, really nice. Really nice, great, and everyone should avail themselves of that for sure. As always, Dr. Joe Cantor, thank you so much for your time, your insight. We know you're busy, but I know that our listening audience truly appreciates your observations.
Thank you, Noel. Pleasure is all mine.
All righty. We will be right back. 504-260-1870. Coming up in the next hour, we'll talk about a couple of different things. What do you think's important? We want to hear from you as we're headed into the debate for tonight. The Judiciary Committee sends the nomination to the Senate floor. They will be voting on that on Monday. What are your thoughts? Stay with us.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance, too, with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic? And conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.